Lloyd Gilmore, Elliot Friedman, was the answer to a question you asked a couple of weeks ago about the Philadelphia Flyers Red Army game in 1976. Who was the referee? It was Lloyd Gilmore.
Oh, okay.
We have the best people, I swear, the best people that listen to this podcast.
Hey, before we get too deep into the podcast, congratulations are in order.
From a kid?
Yes, for your son.
Yes. Joining the Markham Waxers organization.
I mean, we'll put in a hand clap and sound effect here, okay?
No, we're all very happy for him. We're all very
so
very
tell us, tell us quick.
Triple A, Markham Waxers, novice. Final cuts were Thursday night, and he made it.
So novice is 7-8, right?
2010, sir. You got to talk like a hockey dad now.
You're right, yes.
I have a 2010 and 2012. So now,
well, congratulations.
Thank
what's
you.
Your boy's name?
TJ, Trent James.
Congratulations, TJ.
As you'll
I
find out.
I hope your dad doesn't turn into a mean hockey parent.
But your dad will be a poor hockey parent.
Does he have to play sideways or no?
What do you mean?
Like the deal now?
No,
Ontario
no, half
is?
Ice? No.
Yeah, half
no, he,
ice?
His year was the one that missed it.
Okay.
So he plays the full ice. My younger son, Brody, yeah. And you'll pick up right away. Our sons are named TJ and Brody.
Yeah.
No relation or nothing to do with
TJ Brody.
TJ Brody of the Calgary Flames. So he's playing the half ice, which I do like. And I might be in the minority of parents that I hang out with.
I've got a relative who doesn't like it.
There are a lot that don't like it, but I do see the value in it. I find that a lot of Canadian parents who don't like it because it's the American way to develop players.
You know what? The other thing, too, Jeff, is it is outrageous that it's 7 and 8 years old. You got to pay $200 for the tracksuit and the jacket, and you know what? Like, seriously. They can wait.
We have priced a lot of families out of
yes, and that is a huge issue.
We saw it with TJ's team, you know, this year. And I'm not going to get into any specifics. I don't want to talk about anyone specifically on this podcast, but we've seen it firsthand how it does price some families.
Yeah, not right.
Thank you very much for the kind words. And yes, now. Now you start writing checks. All right, kid, you earned it. Now dad's got to pay for it. Okay, but the big news, though, Elliot, and thank you for that. The big news, Bill Peters.
Yes.
Now, ex of the Carolina Hurricanes, as you've talked about for a couple of weeks, both on this podcast and in the column, had the option to exercise an out. He did.
Mm-hmm.
As we tape this podcast, 1 o'clock Eastern on Friday afternoon, Bill Peters is now ex of the Carolina Hurricanes. How soon, he said, is he current of the Calgary Flames? Or am I drawing that A to B a little too obviously? And should we wait until we see maybe there's some interest in Dallas, maybe there's some interest in the Rangers,
it's gonna
or do we just
done.
Say it's going to be Calgary?
Like as you said, we're taping this while it's not official. It's going to get done. He's going to be the coach of the Calgary Flames. And somebody asked me today, a couple people asked me today, you know, why is Bill Peters the hot candidate all of a sudden? And, you know, I think some of it is timing in the sense that if you look at a couple of the openings that are out there, Calgary, they've got a general manager who worked with them and won a gold medal at the World Championships. And Dallas has a general manager who worked with him in Detroit. So these guys both know him.
Yep.
And I think that was a reason. Like, you know, for Brad Treliving, this is going to be his third coaching hire. You're going to go with someone that you know the best, right? And Jim Nill, this is going to be, well, I don't think Hitchcock was as much his hire, but it happened under his watch.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to get the pick, and, you know, he's going to go with someone your general preference is, I'm taking a gamble, so I'm going with someone I know. And I think Bill Peters found himself in a situation where two of the open jobs are run by people he knew.
Because the question becomes, you know, what's so special about Bill Peters? Why is he the hot name? Why is he the big ticket? Why is he, you know, Mr. Sexy right now as it relates to coaches and coaching hires? Am I being overly simplistic in looking at Bill Peters' situation in Carolina like this? Because I really do believe this, and I have for a couple of years. Haven't been shy about mentioning it either. Good coach, bad goaltending.
Yeah, I think there's some of that.
I think Carolina's a good team that's just been the victim of that goal.
Yes, I think that has happened. But I think there's something else to it, too. And, like, I've asked a number of people about it. And if you look at the Hurricanes, they're in a really tough division. What are the two toughest divisions in the league? It's the Central
and
it's the
Metro.
And you look at the Metro, Pittsburgh spends the cap. Washington spends the cap. Philly spends the cap. Rangers spend the cap. Columbus has become a team that now spends the cap.
They spend a lot of money. New Jersey snuck in, though.
You know, New Jersey. But the thing is, like, how many years did it take New Jersey to get back? Carolina is 10 to 15 million less than these teams every year.
And does that change now with Dundon?
I don't know. When I interviewed him first, he said that, you know, I think I don't have his exact quote in front of me, but his quote was, we're going to make smart decisions, and if we decide that we want to keep people, we're not going to lose them because of money. He said, well, somebody could make an insane offer, but generally, you know, if there are guys we want to keep, and for example, he's made it very clear, Sebastian Aho is a guy who wants to keep, he said it's not going to be about money. But you see what he's going through in his organization right now, and he thinks a number of his front office people and coaches have been overpaid, and he's trying to rein that back in. So the jury's still out. But the fact is, when you're 10 to 15 million less consistently than everybody else in your division, it's hard to win. And the other thing, too, is, you know, when you make a mistake, it's hard to get rid of. Scott Darling had a really rough first year.
Yep.
And when you're a team that's 10 to 15 million under the cap,
and you can't get a save,
those mistakes are harder to cover up for. Toronto, if Toronto had Scott Darling, they would, you know, what would they do?
They would Robida Island.
Yeah, he'd go to the minors. You know, if they really believed it couldn't work, they would go to the minors, or they'd buy him out, or they'd trade him somewhere with something else, or they'd do Nathan Horton for David Clarkson. Mm-hmm. These guys can't do that. So I think it does have an effect.
The other part of this equation is now the Carolina Hurricanes are looking for a head coach.
Yes.
Now,
and by the way, the other issue that people tell me with Carolina is that they're not a tough team to play against. And that still is one of the battles between old school and, as we call it on this podcast, information.
Thank you.
And that is that there's a feeling that Carolina, while they have a lot of guys whose numbers look good, they're not a tough team. And the playoffs are reinforcing that you need to be tough to be successful in this league. Not old school 1980s, you know, bench clearing brawl Flyers tough, mm-hmm. but tough in your own way. And I've been told that they have admitted that internally. That's something they have to deal with.
That's one of the things that's dogged Carolina going back years. Yeah. Like, that's nothing new. I mean, that's always been at least salary cap, and I know they did win the Stanley Cup in 2006, which in a lot of ways, with no disrespect to, you know, Chicho's 50 and the Carolina Hurricanes winning the Stanley Cup, I kind of crumple up and I throw 2006 out the window because everyone's learning how to play the game again. Everyone's trying to learn what these rules are all of a sudden. Anyway, so the flip side of this is the Carolina Hurricanes are now looking for a head coach. Earlier on this week, Paul Kropelka comes in as the VP of hockey operations.
Don't fight Paul Kropelka, by the way.
Don't fight Paul Kropelka.
No, I believe he's got a black belt and something.
If you're going to arbitration, you hope that Paul Kropelka is on the other side of the table?
If he if like he doesn't like something you say, Jeff, don't say, let's go into the octagon and sort this out.
So this is like Bob and Doug McKenzie's lawyer in Strange Brew who takes out the media on the stairs. Okay, very good.
Don't fight him.
We're late. Let's go.
Remind me to pay his bill on time, eh?
Yeah. Chuck North for the defense, eh?
Beauties. I've heard he's got a black belt in something.
So looking for a head coach.
Yeah. I think it'll come down to two guys, and they're both internal. I think
Mike Vellucci.
Well, Mike Vellucci.
That seems the obvious one.
And he wants to coach as opposed to being executive.
Yeah.
You know what? Like, their American Hockey League team has a good rep. Like, they develop players.
Warren Fogle's Charlotte Checkers.
Yeah, he took a really big step this year.
He almost made the team last year before he went back to Erie.
And Fogle, I understand, reads the blog and listens to the podcast, so I'm a huge fan.
Okay, so we'll run down the whole wrap. Went to St. Andrews College, into the OHL, brief little stint at NCAA, then went to Kingston, coached by Paul McFarland, and then into the Erie Otters at trade deadline last year. Was outstanding playoff MVP in the OHL. Go ahead, Elliot.
Yeah, and scored his first NHL goal this year. But the Vellucci's done a really good – like, other teams will tell you that they've done a real nice job with their prospects in the AHL this year.
Yeah.
And the other guy, I think, I've heard that Dundon's a big fan of Rod Brind'Amour. Mm-hmm. Rod Brind'Amour is a really smart guy. He sees the game really well. I mean, I've talked to him briefly. Like, he kind of wasn't sure he wanted to be a head coach. But, you know, if he ever does, he's going to have the chance to throw his hat in there.
All right, and with that, we'll begin the podcast now. Welcome to 31 Thoughts, the podcast brought to you by the all-new 2018 GMC Terrain.
So Jeff Merrick and Elliot Friedman, my second favorite duo behind Hall & Oates. And I can tell you, Jeff Merrick, you might not know this, but this guy is tatted up. I mean, he's sort of the rebel in this pair. I mean, that's not hard. Elliot's not much of a rebel, but he's got more tats than Brent Burns and Tyler Sagan, and he's got all sorts of ink everywhere. He's a bit of a wild man. I've got to go out with him some night off work and see what he's all about. Elliot, I've been out with him, and there's not much happening there. He calls himself the triple threat, you know, the podcast and the radio and the TV and all of that stuff. I say overexposed. When he comes on the TV, my kids are like, this guy again? All these thoughts, all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, you know, he's a big shot. At least he keeps telling me he is. But congratulations. The podcast is going well, and I'm glad to make a small, brief, albeit important, appearance.
All right, there you go. So that's David Amber, our good friend from Hockey Night in Canada and from Sportsnet as well. True, I have a lot of ink, and I'll probably continue to get inked until I shed the mortal coil. And two, really boring to go out with. Like, I may be the most boring man to go out with right now. Once upon a time in a different life, that was a different answer. But right now, as my wife likes to say, Jeff, you are born to be mild.
Yes, you know, well, you're also older now. Like, you're in your 40s. We kind of
Oh, my hip. There it goes, Elliot.
Yeah. You know, Amber, it's funny they mentioned Hall & Oates. Like, you know, I've known Dave for a long time. You know, back in, we both broke in TV. I was at the Score and he was at TSN.
Yep.
And, you know, we did a lot. We did playoff runs for both the Leaf and the Raptors together as reporters. Yep. We go to spring training together as reporters. So we've known each other for a long time. The Hall & Oates thing is really funny because there's a camera guy named Paul Steinberg. And Paul Steinberg worked with me at the Score, and Dave knew who he was. And we were all big 80s music fans because we're all children of the 80s. And every day, there was one stretch where every day in the morning, we'd check our voicemails at work, yeah. And there was like a 6-second clip from the 80s, and it was like, name that tune. And we had to give our answer to Paul, and
oh,
he
that's
would
awesome.
Keep score of who knew. And yeah. I would like to say for the record, I won this. Amber gave up, but it was, it's funny, like Amber's, like we've known each other a long time.
You know, it's interesting, you know, amongst the hosts around here, you know, I look at Ron and Ron's the Cadillac, right? Like we've talked about this before on the podcast and, you know, there's a lot of hosts that give me reason to be embarrassed at my performances on television when it's, I mean, Ron does everything so well.
Yep.
You know, Darren's transitions I find are excellent. I go, oh man, I can't do it like that. And David has this presence on TV that you either have or you don't, and you can't fake it. You can't
camera
fake that
funk.
Camera
loves Dave.
Man, he's awesome.
Yeah, like camera
Dave owns a desk when he's there, and
we'll have Dave on at one point.
For sure.
I believe at one time when he was at TSN, I think it was the Leafs when they first came good under Quinn, and I believe the players asked Pat Park, who then was the media relations person for the Maple Leafs, what CFL team David played for.
It's funny, all the guys...
he's really out of shape.
All the guys
like,
at the gym.
I think he wears like extra tight shirts on purpose.
Wouldn't
like,
you?
He goes at the Gap Kids to buy his t-shirts.
All the guys at the gym are like, hey, who's the most jacked guy at Sportsnet right away?
It's like Amber.
Amber. Not even close. Yeah. It's not even a number two.
You know, McLean is... You know, have you ever seen McLean work?
Oh, I know. He's got like Bruce Lee figure.
Of the three of us here, you, me, and Emil, like... I'm in third, and you and Emil are closer.
Is that like saying you're the toughest clown in the circus, though?
That's right.
All right, let's get to some more thoughts for the week. A couple of teams eliminated. Again, we're talking about, you know, this podcast we're recording on the Friday. Quick autopsy, Los Angeles Kings and the Anaheim Ducks, two teams swept, one by Vegas, one by San Jose. One team mustered 3 goals, the other mustered 4. Future of Anaheim. Let's start there. Funny, the morning after they get eliminated, my first thing, get up in the morning, put on a pot of coffee, go to capfriendly.com to look at one thing specifically.
Which one, Perry?
The buyout list.
Yeah.
And who's number one?
Okay, so this is how I look at it. First of all, Anaheim made one small move at the deadline this year. They did Chris Wagner for Jason Chimera.
Yep.
And I
wanted
heard,
to do more.
I heard
St. Louis wanted to do more, and so did Anaheim.
I have a theory on this. I think Anaheim was kicking tires on Van Riemsdyk.
Mm-hmm.
I heard they were also looking around at Jack Johnson, and they decided not to do either. And I don't know if it was because the price was too prohibitive, but I think also some of that was, are we really good enough? And I think internally they were preparing for this was not the year to go for it.
But wait a minute. I thought last year, and more specifically this year, was that last hurrah. And this is the thing behind bringing in Randy Carlyle.
I think they saw during the year that while that was the plan, it probably wasn't going to work.
Every year, are you the same way? Every year, there's usually one team that I have zero feel for.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if they're good. I don't know if they're bad. I have no idea. To me, that team this year was Anaheim. Well, I had no clue what this team was.
It's interesting you say that because normally they start slow and then they really get good. They came to Toronto. I can't remember when they came here, but it was middle of the season. And I got a sense that there was some worry that that second half kick in wasn't going to be there. And, you know, part of it, you look at that as team pessimism, right? Like, like people are just saying that to try to get guys motivated. But, you know, with 2020 hindsight, these people knew what they were talking about. The one thing, I think Anaheim's a really smart organization. I think they're really different, but they find players.
They draft and develop really well.
They draft and develop really well. You know, they're the biggest non-analytic team in the NHL. And I don't know in this day and age if that works anymore, but they still find people because of it. They're generally very good. You know, they got wiped out in the playoffs, and that's going to lead to change.
But what can you do, though? Well, that's my question. Honestly,
I look at this, and I'm like, you're not doing anything with Getzlaff because he's still a player. And I would love to see how Getzlaff's going to be after a summer of rest. Like, he's going to get a lot of rest, and he's more than used to. Kessler. The word I got on Kessler this year was he competed really hard. His body was held together by string.
6.8 times four.
Yeah. So I think you give him a summer off and you see what you got. The big one's going to be Perry. There's no question about that. He's been trending downwards for a few years now.
Really good game four.
You know, and, you know,
mitigating factor.
You know, also he, but you know what?
He's played a lot of hockey, man.
Played a lot of hockey. You know, I was on Calgary radio today and they were like, you know, Corey Perry would look really good in Calgary in a line with Monahan and Goudreau. You know what? Yeah, he probably would, but are you taking 3 years at 8.25? Plus, he's got a no-move clause, so anything that you know you want, he's got to do it. But he's still very smart, you're right, but he's also – he takes the bad penalties, like the one he took at the end of game two, that's got to stop. The other thing I think there too, Jeff, is Gibson. He's coming towards the end of a three-year deal.
1 year, 2.3 remaining. Yeah. I love him this year. To me, he's a top-five goalie for the Vezina.
You know what? He had a great year, but here's the thing. And in a cap world, if you're going to commit big money to a guy...
He's got to get the hospital bracelet off.
You got to know that you can count on him to stay healthy.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you this. Like, I really don't like saying this, so let me preface this. I really don't like saying it, but it's a factor. He's a guy who always gets hurt when he's got the number one job. And you know who they used to say that about before they knew he had MS was Josh Harding.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote that once in my blog that Josh Harding had the reputation of a guy who something happens to him when the number one job comes up. And I got a call from someone who said, who told you that? Because it hit too close to home.
Right.
And I think the Ducks look at Gibson and they say, you know what? He's a great goalie. He's really talented. But why do we always have to deal with this? And it's very difficult to commit to guys like that. And I don't want to come across like I'm questioning him. I'm just saying the facts are this. And that does become a factor when you're talking about a long term.
Having said that, when he's on and when
great.
He's healthy, he's a top five. He's a sneaky top three Vezina Trophy candidate. You know, he's not in there, but he's a sneaky top three.
I got to tell you, like, we're tweeting out these awards nominees, and everybody's annoyed. Like, I'll just say, like, it was tough this year, man. These were not easy this year.
I want to get to Selke and, Norris here in a couple of seconds.
Sure.
But I want to get your thoughts on the Los Angeles Kings.
Yeah.
And this is a team that deliberately this year went out and said, we need to get faster. Hello, Alex Alafalo.
Yep. I liked him, too.
So did I. I think they all did. I think it was a surprise and a revelation seeing him up on the top line. Here comes Adrian Kempe and more. Like, when they played those games in China, every time we talked to someone in and around the L.A. organization, they kept coming back to the same thing. We're too slow. Like, L.A. was never a fast team. Even when they were winning Stanley Cups, they played a very deliberate possession monster style, albeit under Daryl Sutter. But they were a big straight-line hockey team, and they were never quick. That's why Gabrick stood out so much. But they've gone deliberately now to try to fill this roster and populate this roster by players that are faster.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen overnight.
And I see L.A., like, if I was giving advice to the Kings, it would be stay the course. Like, I know you're disappointed. I know you got beat 4-0, but they were in all those games. You're on a path where you're changing who you are. You're changing your identity. You have to see that path through.
Yep.
I think they're going to sign Doughty. I would be surprised if he does not re-sign.
Do you want to throw a dart at the decimal point?
Well, Kopitar's what, 10-5? So Doughty's 11. I'm sure they'll offer him the same as Kopitar. Do you want to take the same number?
Sure.
And we'll see what he says. But, like, I think it's probably going to be, you know.
Offer him the same number or same percentage of cap?
Yeah, you know, maybe that's – if the agent probably does that, if they're smart.
Yeah.
Like, I know with McDavid's deal, and it's Newport, so those guys aren't dumb. But McDavid, it was percentage of cap. And you're right. Like, that's a good point that you bring up. It's something like that.
Sure.
So he's going to come in around anywhere from 10-5 to 11-5.
LA is a fascinating team. Like, there's still players that are in, I mean, Anze Kopitar, Selke, Drew Doughty, Norris,
yeah.
Jonathan Quick.
And Drew Doughty, we're joking about this, but I'm not supposed to say this, but Doughty was number one on my ballot.
And you're really good at revealing these things that you're not supposed to do. I can't wait till we get to Selke and we get to Norris Trophy here in a second. I'm going to take a little pause. When we come back, should have mentioned this off the top. Now, don't be scared if you're not a Bruins fan, because the whole interview is not going to be about the Boston Bruins. It's going to be a lot about the industry. It's going to be a lot about his job. There are a couple of very significant historical references thrown in because, after all, it is Jack Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
But after the break here, we're here.
You have to stay right to the end because Jeff asked a fantastic question late in this interview that I never would have thought of.
Really? You liked it that much?
That's called a listener hook.
It's a great question. Really good. Top 10 question that I get about one a year. And this is my one. And it's in the interview with Nesson's Jack Edwards. And that's next when 31 Thoughts, the podcast, returns. The all-new 2018 GMC Terrain is the compact SUV thoughtfully designed with you in mind. With features like the Traction Select system to revolutionize how you adapt to the road, a fold flat front passenger seat to give you up to 8 feet of cargo space, and an innovative electronic precision shift system to make shifting easier than ever, the 2018 GMC Terrain is truly mighty like a pro. GMC, we are professional grade.
Please welcome Nesson Bruins play-by-play announcer, Jack Edwards.
Oh, he's such a homer. He's such a homer.
Get over it. You go to hockey games to get excited.
Going on the breakout, then try to generate.
Oh, Boychuk with a green light hit just outside the Boston line. And now there's a brawl. A Stajan is wondering what city he's in.
A little bit of contact. Oh, that's a sell job.
Oh, come on.
Pretty good sell job there by Spezza.
Oh, my God, man. They never work again.
Hamlet goes down as if shot. Get up! Here comes Cavallari. Montreal trying to nurse ridiculous calls out of the referee.
And it's heart attack time in the booth.
Carolina takes possession right back. And an elbowing call coming here against Chad Rose. And he's just yapping all the way to the box. Oh, it's got to be tempting to give him an extra two for the mouth.
A crew comes over, and now Phaneuf is going to act as if he's been shot. And McQuaid says, look, if you want to go, they built the original Boston Garden for boxing, you know.
It's 3-on-1, Eliash to Kovalchuk, he dangles. Oh, Thomas robs Kovalchuk. Ah, you better pay him in rubles. That was an unbelievable save off the Russian.
This is unbelievable that the National Hockey League has let this happen.
Anderson down on his front.
And they're going to leave the plate dead with the Bruins on the power play coming into the attacking zone. I mean, I understand if this is a peewee game or if there's a bone sticking out of his leg, but that is utterly ridiculous. I mean, the Bruins are on the power play. It's the third period of a playoff game. It's a one-goal game, and you're going to stop the play for a guy who's still conscious? Concuss that!
Elliot, pleased to be joined by Nesson's Bruins play-by-play voice, Jack Edwards. Follow him on Twitter, @ real Jack Edwards. First of all, Jack, thanks so much for stopping by today.
I didn't think it was necessary for you guys to wear goalie masks, but I can understand.
Elliot's idea, I assure you.
I look better when my face is obscured.
He looks better with the Jerry Cheevers, with the stitches all over it. I'm a Joel Gilbert guy myself. I mentioned the Twitter handle. How has Twitter treated you?
You know, in the evolution of Twitter over the last 6 or 7 years, it went from something that was really useful to get news out to being an interesting forum to being an open sewer. And actually, during the playoffs, I turn off the mentions and responses columns on my tweet deck just because it's too much noise. And I'm not running a talk show. I'm providing some opinions, and people want to...
When you do info, this game lineup, some previews that you feel like there's information. Like
I'll throw information out.
Part of what makes Twitter great is when it's a wire service.
Right.
It's the best wire service probably that we have.
Yeah. Useful information. Yeah.
Now, you do tweet out your lineup cards, and that's one thing I do want to ask you about. First of all, you must have a template on your computer.
Yes.
What program do you use?
I use a proprietary piece of software that I've generated myself.
Now, are you going to sell this at any point in time?
If there's a venture capitalist out there, I can tell you this. I can tell you this, that I pitched it to a gigantic computer company that is involved in sports, and they decided that they'd rather be an infrastructure company than an owner of software. I also pitched it to a well-known investment group that happens to own a team that's won 5 Super Bowls. That's located close to the Boston Bruins.
Would it rhyme with schmaft?
Yeah. And both of them, independent of one another, asked me after I did my pitch, does the NFL know about this? Because the real money for my game charts, as much as I love the NHL, the real money would be in college and pro football and college and pro basketball. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of digressing.
Because I am fascinated with this stuff. Because I've seen how people do it, and it goes from relatively simple to extremely complicated. And I remember reading a book, Gary Bender, who was a big-time play-by-play broadcaster. He posted his sheets and how he did it in his book. And it was the first time I really saw it. How long did it take you to put together this program?
Well, the long answer is about 30 years, and the short answer is about 3 to 3.5 years of the evolution through the digital format. It's a lot of trial and error, and when you're writing code, if you make even one teeny tiny mistake, it blows up the whole thing, and I'm not really good at that kind of patience.
Okay, so what do you consider the most important information? What information as a play-by-play guy do you have to have on your sheets?
Trends. And the reason that I went digital with all my paper charts was so that I could do more analysis and less clerical work. So by having automatic downloads, a couple of web scrapes, a database that I can collect from authorized sources and from subscription sources, that I quickly can scan game logs and get quantifiable, meaningful trend-type stats. Like, I can quickly go through Kessel, Malkin, Crosby, maybe Hornquist, and give you quickly how many goals, assists, points in how many games, and how many of those have come at even strength, how many have been power play dependent, etc. And that used to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, counting manually up the printed out game notes, which was really effective but incredibly laborious and dull as heck.
Yeah.
So now I can do a whole team. I look at every single player who is on the roster and eligible to play that night, and I'm able to go through both teams in about 20 minutes.
It's a big improvement, Jeff.
Yeah. You mentioned looking at trends and seeing how things are developing. Is that mainly goal-based, like traditional goals, hits, assists, the sort of boxcar stats that we've all grown up with? Or do you start to get into more of the analytical shot-based metrics, things like that? Does that interest you?
Yeah, well, it interests me, but I had a really interesting discussion with a woman who is a statistics graduate student at the University of New Hampshire, which is also my alma mater. And she was a youth hockey player and still is obsessed with the sport. And we were talking about analytics. And the problem that I have with hockey analytics is that, and I may be ignorant of the solution here, but the problem I have with hockey analytics is that they were all based on the baseball template. And baseball is a series of isolated one-on-ones. It's the pitcher against the batter, maybe even with a certain count and a certain number of people in different positions on bases and certain depths in the game. But it's a static event. Hockey, to find the quality of a player's play and quantify it, you have to take into account the other 9 or 8 or 7 players who are on the ice with that player at that time, and then apply all the other variables to it. And that algorithm simply does not exist, to the best of my knowledge.
But basketball does it.
Where you can
include...
Soccer
does it. Other flow sports do it. Why is hockey different?
To me, it hasn't hit me like the cartoon character walking along the sidewalk who gets the anvil dropped on his head from the 7th floor. I haven't had that bong moment with an analytical stat to make me say, wow, this is so valuable that I should take time out of every game day to analyze these stats and include them.
The reason I find this so interesting, too, is calling Boston Bruins games from an – and I hate using – Elliot and I have talked about – I hate the term analytics because it polarizes people.
Yes, puts
people
in
camps right away, and I can't stand it for that. But, I mean, there are two possession monsters on this team, Zdeno Chara and Patrice Bergeron.
Right.
And during that 2011 run, when those two were on the ice together, nobody else touched the puck.
Yeah.
I mean, pick your metric. To pick on how you judge the game or break it down or slice – nobody else was touching the puck when these two guys were on the ice. It was one of the most dominating possession events in that season they had together when they were on the ice was remarkable. And I always thought, man, if I'm someone calling Bruins – all I'm doing is saying, look at Bergeron and look at Chara, and these are the numbers that back it all up.
Yeah, those two guys have been just remarkable to be able to watch them play in day in and day out. And I think we're only going to understand Chara's value when you look at one of those heat maps of where opposition shots come from and how the left side, as the goalie is looking out of his defensive zone, the left side is always so cool in relation to the other side of the ice. After Chara retires, you know, a couple of years later, those heat maps are probably going to balance out for Boston, but now there are a lot fewer chances coming from the left side of the defensive zone than the right. It's astonishing how Chara has adapted to a game in which the prototypical forward has gone from being Eric Lindros when Chara broke in to Patrick Kane and Sidney Crosby and Connor McDavid in the modern day. And you think about this one human being having to adapt to that change and the change in the rules and how you just can't run a guy into the boards and water ski with him all the way down to the corner. It's amazing that he's still as effective as he is.
Yes. See,
to me, my pet theory, I think I've told you about, I think you may have mentioned it on the pod a while ago, my pet idea for Zdeno Chara is, I think, going back to when he broke in the league, all right, Islanders, Ottawa, into Boston, I think every year he should win the Lady Bing Trophy. Not for what he does, but for what he has the potential to do and chooses not to.
Yeah.
Like, if he wanted to, Jack, and you see all the games, he could lay waste to this league.
Oh, yeah.
But doesn't.
Yeah.
When you consider, essentially, we've got Shrek out there who could lay waste to everybody on the ice and chooses not to, that to me is a definition of a gentlemanly hockey player. Agree or disagree?
I think he is an appropriately gentlemanly hockey player, but I was known to give Brian Campbell a whole load of garbage over winning Lady Bing as a defenseman because, as my colleague Bob Beers, who calls color for Boston Radio, has said, and sort of, you know, wishing that Brandon Carlo had a little of this in him. You know, it's not the worst thing in the world for a defenseman every once in a while to cross-check somebody in the jaw, right? You know, Josh Morrissey in the playoffs accepted. But to have a reputation is important. And that players understand that Chara is so strong and still so mobile, relatively speaking, for a guy 6'9", and has such fire in his belly That's, what did they call it during the Cold War? Mutually assured destruction.
That's a
deterrent, right? Mm-hmm. Don't launch your missiles.
Your nuclear deterrent wearing 33. Yeah, right.
Now, Jack, curiosity. Have the Bruins ever come to you and said, Jack, that was too much?
The only time I've heard directly from the team, and I've heard indirectly in vague terms, and I must say that especially for my style and my ability to go off the emotional end of the pier with pretty regular frequency, especially in the playoffs, that the team has done a remarkable job of maintaining an arm's length relationship, and I thank them for forgiving me. But the only time I heard directly was when Milan Lucic crushed Randy Jones in a game in Philadelphia one Saturday afternoon. I believe it was in the 09 season because it was the year after.
Is that the response to Bergeron?
Jones had nearly broken Patrice Bergeron's neck. And I'll tell you, that day, which was also a Saturday matinee, that game was in Boston. I actually thought that Bergeron was dying on the ice when they cut his visor off his helmet, and he still hadn't come to. I mean, we were on the air for 16 minutes straight, I think, when he was down, and we might have said 30 words in those 16 minutes. It was so scary. So anyway, Lucic catches up to Randy Jones and just trucks him into the end boards, and the fans in Philadelphia were outraged, and I said, how's this for irony?
Carcillo takes it down, Jones on the end boards. Lucic hammers it! Down goes Jones, and how's this for irony? The crowd wants a call for a hit from behind! It's true! What a game we got going! Lucic mashes Jones! Cry me a river!
Fans in Philadelphia want a penalty on Lucic for a hit from behind on Randy Jones. Cry me a river, and I laughed derisively, and that went beyond the bounds of good sportsmanship, and I probably deserved at least a slap on the wrist for that.
You see, I have a theory. First of all, when I was younger and more idealistic, I think, or maybe naive, I would say is even a better word of looking at it, was I didn't like that kind of broadcasting. And I, like, for example, I would listen to the Chicago White Sox broadcasters, Tom Pashorek and Ken Harrelson.
Yeah.
And they were like the ultimate homers, and it would drive me crazy. And as I got older and I began to see more of the world, I began to understand that there's room for everybody. And if everybody sounded the same, we'd all be boring as hell. And secondly, I realized also that, you know, you're working for the home team. You may not, I don't know how your situation goes. I don't know who you're paid by, but you're a home team broadcast. Like Rick Janerat once told me in Buffalo, says, I'm not a journalist. I'm an entertainer. I'm there to entertain the fans of the Buffalo Sabres. And you were an ESPN guy before. I remember you doing World Cup soccer.
Yep.
When you got the Bruins job, how did you decide about, okay, this is the guy I'm going to be, and this is the way I'm going to call the games?
Yeah, that's a really interesting line of questioning, because when I was at ESPN, I had equal enthusiasm for both teams, no matter which teams were playing. The other dynamic of that is that when you're working a network job, you may see a team 8 times a year if you're really hitting that team with a lot of frequency. Most of my job at ESPN was doing ESPN 2 Pacific Division games. So I knew the Pacific Division really, really well. I didn't know a whole lot about the rest of the league because it was hit and miss. When you're with a team for 82 games a year, or 72 after the ones that NBC National takes, you develop a prism through which you see the entire National Hockey League. And also, as a regional broadcaster, you understand that your audience sees it through that same prism. And I've actually found that I can analyze and understand the NHL a whole lot better with that view than I ever was able to when I was working for ESPN. And it's probably a result of the way my mind works, which is, I found the anxieties I had at ESPN were that I needed to have a spectrum that was a mile wide and about a quarter of an inch deep, that I had to know something about everybody, but I rarely had the time really to drill down on any one team or any one subject. And with the Bruins, I'm about a quarter of an inch wide and a mile deep. Mm-hmm. And that better suits my kind of brain for what's left of it. And so that was actually, it's been much better for my learning process. The evolution of my emotional reactions on the air was kind of in two stages. One was when I got the job. I mean, I must admit that when they told me I had the job, I hung up the phone and I gave it the old Ray Bork fist pump. I was so excited.
The rancor.
Because I grew up with the Boston Bruins. I watched those seasons when Eddie Johnston played every single game for a team that did not make the playoffs in a league in which four out of six made the playoffs. I watched every single game that was available. They weren't all on TV back then. In fact, when Fred Cusick started doing radio of Boston Bruins games, couldn't find a sponsor for the whole game, and they would just do the second and third period. And if it was 4-0 after one, Cusick would be like, oh, my gosh, the game's over, and I'm just starting. So that was the team with which I grew up. And in the mosh pit that was the 2011 victorious dressing room in Vancouver, I'm in this crowd of spray and shouting and music and crazy happiness, and I bump into somebody from behind, and David Krejci had the cup over his head, and he just handed it to me. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, the first thing I thought, and I felt a little bit of guilt because I neither lost teeth nor bled for that team, mm-hmm. but for him to hand it to me, and then I'm holding, the first thing I thought of was, this is the same cup that Jean Beliveau held over his head while I cried into my pillow as a child. So I mean, seriously, that was the first thing I thought. So now you get my emotional background as a kid who grew up 50 miles north of Boston, and this miracle named Bobby Orr came along and just elevated the sport into something that was supernatural in New England. And so there was that basic emotion there with the Boston Bruins. Along the line, and I was continuing to do freelance games for Versus, which was the escapee from the U.S.'s Outdoor Life Network, yep. which then NBC swallowed whole and turned into the NBC Sports Network. And I was still sort of restrained in my limits on myself. And then I had a major falling out with John Shannon when he was in his brief tenure as the vice president of broadcasting for the NHL, because I felt that no one at the league office, as they were not only not contributing a dime to my salary, but also encroaching on regional rights at a very regular and alarming rate, which was hurting our audience, hurting my network's income. I talked back very loudly mm-hmm. to him and to others at the NHL. And for that, my reward in the spring of 2008 was to be informed that I no longer would be used on NHL national broadcast. I was totally okay with that. But in processing that, instead of being angry or bitter about it, I treated it as liberation. I really felt like, great, you know, I don't have to suck up to anybody anymore. I no longer have to put a filter on that. I can give it to Bruins fans exactly the way they want it. The way the TV rights have worked in the U.S. for the last 15 years is that the regional networks, who are the lifeblood of NHL.com's video source, who are absolutely the only thing that makes NHL Network worth watching during the regular season, because it's 90% of the source material for all their highlights and all their analysis, those regional networks are getting their toes clipped, their ankles clipped, their knees sawed off, and they're really getting brutalized. And NBC continues to horn in on whatever angle it can. And ultimately, I don't think that's good for hockey. If you look at the big media picture these days, It is more and more of a splintered marketplace. You know, when's the last time you bought a PC? Well, chances are you went online and you picked out what speed processor you wanted, how much RAM you wanted, how much you wanted your main hard drive to be, whether it was a digital hard drive or a regular spinning hard drive, right? And you put that all into a box. Well, cosmetically, your PC may look just like the guy on the desk next to you, but chances are the guts of it are completely different. We live in an individualized world, and more consumers are demonstrating that what they want is what is most important to them and the most localized, direct version of the interpretation of the world to them. And I'm going to sort of loop back to Elliot's early listenings here.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Wilson, who was my model as a play-by-play announcer, the brilliant Hall of Famer who had the unmistakable baritone voice, he said of calling Bruins games, objective, no, but we try to be fair. Mm-hmm. And my audience is six quirky states in the northeast corner of the United States with multi-generational heritage of passing down membership in the Bruins tribe. And that's the audience to which I speak. And, you know, I've said it several times that New Englanders consume more ice cream than anybody in the world, but but we do not serve vanilla at our location.
I do want to mention, Nesson is hosting, that was a great answer, by the way, hosting a 60-minute pre- and post-game show for all Bruins games throughout the playoffs. Also, Nesson's streaming app, Nesson Go, available for mobile phones or tablets online, nessongo.com. Also, you can stream games in Canada on SN Now. Go to snnow.ca for more. Further to that, because as you mentioned, you do have that emotional attachment to the Boston Bruins.
Yeah.
It is impossible to say Nesson's Jack Edwards without thinking about the Boston Bruins. That is a hand-to-glove relationship. TV does weird things to people, as you well know. Let's say next season, Jack Edwards finds himself not calling Boston Bruins games, but in a situation where he's calling Anaheim Ducks games. A, how difficult would that be for you to detach yourself from the Boston Bruins and calling those games? And B, would you be able to? You know, we think of, you know, hockey players have a hard time. We just saw Taylor Hall go through this when he had his mulligan year last year with the New Jersey Devils, boo-boo face, and didn't turn it around until this season.
If I had a Hart Trophy vote, he gets it, by the way.
Remarkable season. Yeah. Remarkable season, no doubt.
I'm not allowed to say this, but I voted for MacKinnon with Hall second.
Okay. So I'm in
the ballpark. I thought you were going to say if Bergeron would have stayed healthy, he should have had the Hart, because that would have been mine.
Yeah, he was number one on my list before he got hurt.
He was on his
hurt.
Way, yeah. Right.
Would you be able to do that? Would you be able to say, okay, you know what, I'm doing Ducks games now, and the passion and everything that I brought to Boston, I'm bringing to Anaheim?
Well, two-part answer. Can you imagine being my producer and expecting me to run on time? I mean, you know, Ryan Zucello, it's remarkable that he's not committed, right? So, two-part answer. I have never, drawing on my early skills in this industry, and I did start as a radio news reporter and went into sports news from there. Drawing on my abilities to make observations and having been reminded by a mentor very early on, really, really, really pay attention. I mean, like, really pay attention. I have never been to an NHL game where I have not seen something unique. It may be an individual's performance over 2.5 hours. It may be something that only took a tenth of a second, like Crosby finding a rebound off of his own shot that hit the post and volleying it in.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something there. Every single NHL game I've ever watched that has been unique and interesting and exciting to me. And I don't think I'll ever lose that thirst for the game. So there's there's a high level of natural enthusiasm built in there. For me, the most exciting games are games in which there is a fan base that is emotionally committed. And you have that with all of the original six. You certainly have that with Philadelphia. You have that with Tampa Bay, which has done a phenomenal job of evangelizing the game to an audience that was completely foreign to it before. Who was it? Bill Davidson went in there and transformed that franchise by saying something, and I'm paraphrasing, and I heard this third hand, so I don't know if he ever said it, but purchasing the team is just the beginning of the work. Now we've got to double that investment and reach out to the community, and that is a great hockey town now. I mean, it is a great hockey town. I need that emotional commitment from the fans so they understand when I go to 13 on the 1 to 10 scale that it's legit, right?
But how much do fans come up with you? Like, maybe even in a visiting game, do you have many fans come up to you?
Yeah, yeah.
And what do they say?
Well, over 99% of them are really good sports about it.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree with that.
They like to tease me, I think that, you know, how deep can we go? This is great. I think that relates directly to the handshake line, where you get guys who are just beating the crap out of each other for seven games over 2 weeks with off days to think about how the grudges are boiling up in the pot. And at the end of it, they say, okay, I get it. You were trying to win. We were trying to win. It got a little out of hand, but, you know, we'll see you next year on the rink. And I honestly think that attitude and emotion permeates what it is to be a true fan of the National Hockey League and of the sport itself. That you understand that the greatest passions arise when there is partisan polarization and you really have the oil and water. And most fans who are for opposing teams bring that with them. And the overwhelming majority do that. I've had a couple of people get in my face, but, you know, that's okay. You know, it's never gotten really nasty. But most people just chuckle, you know?
Yeah. And they want a picture or something, like, can you take a selfie with me?
Yeah, the selfie generation, right?
No, but, I got to tell you, Jack, like, I agree with you. I think 99% of the fans I meet are great. Yeah. You know, 1%, whatever, you can deal with that. But I think if you are nice to people for 2 minutes, take a picture, shake their hand, thanks very much for being a fan. That's all they want. They just want to know for those couple of minutes that you can treat them like they're important. And that's big.
And I think that in this age, that media companies should become more and more aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time I've made myself directly accessible to fans and to give the fans access to things like my play-by-play charts or, you know, some stat that I can share with them on a less than completely mass media basis, I've gotten back loyalty and friendship in spades from those people. And across the board, I don't know about the Canadian numbers, but across the board in the U.S., all sports ratings are down about 6%, and some of them are down in double digits. And I think it's because that the media companies have not adjusted to the changed paradigm of what it is to market sports to individuals rather than just to say, here it is, it's one size box and everybody's got to fit into that, because the entertainment marketplace and the data marketplace is just way too populated.
You know what I think part of that is? I'm so glad you touched on that. One of the things that I really believe is one of the great things about being and we'll just say hockey for the sake of this conversation, obviously in this podcast, one of the great things about being a hockey fan sometimes is hating hockey.
Yeah.
And I think media companies have a hard time embracing that. Everything has to have the smiling face on it, right? But, you know, you don't have, you know, when you have a wave, you don't have a crest without a trough. Like, there has to be both.
Right.
And I think that it's healthy to respect that at certain times fans are going to hate hockey, and that's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fine.
Yeah.
What are the two biggest things in passion? Love and hate, right?
Love and hate. Right.
They come with each other.
Okay. Here's an anecdote about a player that I really respect. And Nazem Kadri is a nightmare when he's on his game.
Mm-hmm.
On the morning of game one, the media horde around him had dissipated somewhat. And I went up to Nazem, and, you know, we know each other from years of, you know,
just chatting.
Yeah, exactly. And I said, you know, I really think you've done a good job in the last couple of years of channeling bad emotions into positive energy. And he said, yeah, you know, I think that's part of the maturation process. And I mean, the guy is sincere, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm going through it with him, and he snaps that night. And he just about crushed Wingles' head like a teenager popping a zit into the mirror. I mean, my gosh, you know, it was a terrible, nasty moment. And I thought, like, you know, even having talked about it, what, at 11 o'clock in the morning, so what, you know, it was like 7 hours before, 8 hours before, mm-hmm. he still had that snap factor. That's how emotional hockey is. And it's those troughs and crests. Yeah. And that pervades every single facet of the game. And it's one of the things that fascinates me most about hockey, how in the speed of the game, in the awesome requirements of the athletes in the game, there are those snap moments where something completely uncharacteristic or unpredictable or counter to a guy's consciously stated thoughts happens anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, sports is always, and hockey is a perfect example of this, is that fight between what your head knows and what your heart feels.
Tell
right?
me about
that,
it.
You know that, Jeff, right? And it's full of wonderful personalities. And there's one personality in the history of the Boston Bruins. Well, there's plenty, but there's one that's top of mind for me where I really throw my hands up in the air. And the answer to me is, I don't know, but you probably have a better answer to this than I don't know. Who was Tim Thomas?
Wow.
Well, that's a great question. That is a great question.
Timmy is in his own world, and there may be no better place for a goalie to be who's going to spin seven consecutive games against two consecutive Hart and Ross Trophy winners and a team that was threatening to run, as the horse racing guys say it, negative splits, because Vancouver won in seven in the first round, six in the second round, yeah. five in the conference final, and they won the first two games of the Stanley Cup final, and they're going to be the first team ever to go 7-6-5-4 and parade around with the cup. And Thomas just got in that zone and absolutely shut him down. I think that Tim didn't have an easy childhood and has had to fight. And his parents are very loving people. And incredibly hardworking people.
And they pawn their wedding rings when you go to hockey school?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. And have had to work ridiculously hard as they have been systematically screwed by corporate America and a government that didn't look out for the laborers and the people who actually do the work, as opposed to the people who... Well, you know, we say it about the Bruins tribe. The heart and soul of the Bruins tribe are people who shower after work and not before. And the people who shower after work were ignored by the government and exploited by corporations for a long time and nowhere more than in Michigan, which is where Tim grew up. And I think that that really bruised him. And I guess if I were to boil it down to one anecdote, I mentioned something about global warming, and he immediately came back to me and said, global warming's a hoax. And, you know, so we got into it pretty deep for about 10 minutes. But, you know, I was on one side of it and he was on another, and I realized that he was not going to change his stance based on stuff that I thought wasn't verified by peer-reviewed studies. But, you know, whatever. The other thing I got to say about Tim was that a member of the media once asked him in a scrum, you're competing against Tuukka, as Tuukka Rask was the backup
yep.
at that time. And he interrupted the question. He said, no, I'm not competing against him. I'm competing with him. And Tim Thomas, who is as a red meat capitalist as you possibly could find, I think had his perspective changed by being in the Finnish league, where he was goaltender of the year before the Bruins signed him because Andrew Raycroft was holding out. He was insurance.
Yes.
Nice insurance policy, right? So by playing in Finland, which is a highly socialized environment, you find that people are more concerned with raising every boat rather than having a couple of steamships and a couple of rowboats that have holes in them. And it was almost ironic that Timmy expressed that. But in the concept of a team, that's how he thought. And he understood that Tuukka Rask raised his game by playing excellent backup goaltending, as Bruce Cassidy demonstrated early this season when Tuukka was in a real funk. And Cassidy put Anton Khudobin in there, and Khudobin lit it up.
That was great.
And Rask wanted to get back in, and Cassidy said, not yet, not yet. And it really got under Rask's saddle. But you know what? That led to that streak. What was it? He went like 20-0-2. And it was a direct result of Bruce leaving Khudobin in a little longer.
Of all the players you've broadcast, who was the one you had the best relationship with, and why?
Mm. The best relationship. Well, Chara's right up there. I admire Z on so many levels, but it starts with his endless curiosity about the world and how I can share any factoid or viewpoint or opinion with him, and he'll come back with something that's really interesting. As a guy who was born on the wrong side of the Iron Curtain, mm-hmm. and has become incredibly wealthy through this effort and application of his understanding of the world, he ranks right up there. Sean Thornton, the communication was not as frequent,
mm-hmm.
but you could go a week without having a conversation with Thorny, but he would come over to you and say three sentences and you'd totally get it,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, that's his personality. And he's a phenomenal communicator, as you all know from having had brief glances with him.
Last one at my microphone, Jack, and we thank you for your time. Very generous. Mm-hmm. Real Jack Edwards is the Twitter handle. And this might be a quirky one, and I'm kind of throwing it at you blind here, but you talked about the old Boston Garden earlier on in the interview. And wonderful rink. So many great memories Bruins fans certainly have their triumphs. One of the great things, there used to be a sign, the Boston Garden, Lady Bing died here, which really in a lot of ways encapsulated what it was to not only be a Boston Bruin, but to be a Boston Bruin fan. You mentioned showering after work, not before it, roll up the sleeves.
Yeah.
You know, we'll play a skill game, we'll play a tough game, we'll play it any way you want. I always loved the idea of that sign and seeing pictures of that sign as a kid. Is there a sign you saw the old Garden in Boston now where you said, you know what? Yeah, that nails it. It's a tough one. I know I'm putting you on the spot.
As you were conjuring up this description, there also used to be a gigantic banner. I mean, like a 30 by 50 foot banner that hung down from the ceiling that said no smoking on it. And it was always clouded in smoke, which sums up the attitude of New Englanders who basically in 1775 stood on the shore and gave the finger to King George III and said, come and get us. And, you know, the ridiculousness of that, I think, is through and through in every New Englander's spirit. There's a pugnaciousness that if an authority tells you to do something, that you're almost compelled either not to do it or to do something subversive to counteract that, just so you can say, see, you can't make me, which is really, really stupid in a lot of ways. But, you know, I've been called worse.
It would, Elliot, it would not be an in-depth interview with Jack Edwards without a strong historical reference.
Well, yeah, it's true. I have to say, the night I got married, I lit up a cigar right underneath a no smoking in this room, $5,000 sign.
Well done.
So for that one night, I had something in common with the people of Boston.
Awesome. Jack, thank you so much for being generous with your time. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Tired of subscribing to multiple streaming services to get your sports fix? Introducing Sportsnet Now. Live stream the entire Stanley Cup playoffs, the Blue Jays, Raptors, and NBA, Premier League, MasterCard, Memorial Cup, and much, much more, all in one subscription. You can stream on the go or at home on your big screen from the most popular devices, including smartphones, tablets, Apple TV, Xbox, and Chromecast. Sign up for as long as you want and cancel whenever you'd like. Get the best bang for your buck with the sports streaming subscription that gets you the most content. Visit snnow.ca for more details. I really enjoyed that interview with Jack Edwards. And you know what, Elliot? Now that I heard it with my own ears, man, my question was good. The question was really,
It was a great question. It really was. You know, it's funny. Like, I guess, Emil, you sent out a tweet yesterday that, you know, Jack was in. Someone said to me, like, did you grill him on his stuff? And, you know, I spoke to the guy and I said, look, like, I look at it two ways. Like, we did. We talked about some of the things that he got in trouble for. But I'm a big believer in Jeff. If we have a guest on, do we do the same? There's some things you have to touch on, but you do the same old, or try to get something different. And for me, like, you try to get something a little bit different.
My style isn't that. You know, that I don't like, because I got the same thing on Twitter. Oh, did you go after him? I'm not a big go after kind of guy. I find you get more.
I think you have to save your bullets. There's times you got to do it. Absolutely.
Listen, I choose conversation over confrontation, and I find that you can get things. Anyway, personally, I mean, I'm not a lawyer.
There's times you got to bear the fangs, but I like to try to find out some different stuff if we can.
And we did, I thought, with Jack Edwards, and we thank him so much for stopping by. And we hope that even if you're not a Bruins fan, you stuck around for the entire interview, because I think Jack's a fascinating guy. I want to get your thoughts on a couple of things you don't have to reveal if you do not want, but these are all voted by the Professional Hockey Writers Association. Selke, Bergeron, Couturier, Kopitar, a couple of things. This is one of those awards, it seems, that there's a gatekeeper for new people standing in front of it. But once you're in, you're in.
Yeah.
Like, Tron Couturier is in.
Yeah.
Took him a couple of years.
Yeah.
Anze Kopitar is in.
And Bergeron
has been in for a long time. But it's one of those awards where you need to, you know, have the magic wand waved over you to get into the conversation. I'm more curious, not necessarily about those that are in and are going to win, but who's the guy knocking on the door?
It's Barkov.
Or is it Radek Faksa?
No, you know what? I'll tell you this. I had Barkov in my – I can't remember 100%, but I think he was in my top three.
Okay.
He was on my ballot, and I think he was in my top three. I believe that Barkov is knocking on the door ahead of Radek Faksa. Now, I will tell you that late in the season, I had a Dallas Star reach out to me and say, do you have a vote? And I said, yeah. He goes, you got to start talking about Faksa. So I did really start to pay attention to him at the end.
Excellent.
But I
just
like, you know, I have to tell you, Jeff, like, a couple of years ago, I kind of really, when I got a vote, I really forced myself to sit and think about how I vote for these things. Like, one of the things I write on the piece of paper before I do it is recency bias. I say to myself, don't always go for the guy who finishes up strong, because I'm guilty of that as much as that. So I write that. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, I believe, look, like, at the beginning, you know, okay, let's say I vote for this guy to win the Hart. Okay. I vote for this guy to win the Hart. And then I say, well, this guy didn't win the Hart, so I'm going to give him the Selke or the Bing.
Right.
I stop doing that, because if the guy you pick is good enough to win the Hart trophy, he should win the Bing and the Selke too, if he qualifies. Mm-hmm. But I do think Barkov is the guy who's knocking at the door.
Do you find it odd? And I think, you know, Silfverberg is probably the only one you can include in this conversation right now that fits this bill. That wingers just don't get, I mean, listen, Marian Hossa should have won this trophy at least once in the course of his career. He didn't. There's that, I don't know, bias, or maybe just say, listen, the resume of a center winks at the Selke a lot more than a winger does. But I can't remember who it was. It might have been Jonathan Willis who raised this question at The Athletic. He said, you know, considering this was a trophy essentially created for Bob Gainey.
Yeah.
If Bob Gainey played in the NHL right now, would he have won this award?
You know, it's a great question. Here's the thing, though. And I've had coaches say to me, like, there's no centers and wingers anymore. There's F1, F2, F3.
Sure, you can dress them. Bill Peters always said that, too, about all of his players.
You know what? Like, and I've thought about that, and I think there's fair comments to be made. But at the end of the day, Jeff, like, look how teams get built. It's center, it's D, and it's goalie. Wingers are important, but if you're ranking the positions, they're not as important.
It's just easier to find them, I think, than high-end guys. There are more available wingers.
Who's everybody looking for? Centers.
Of course. My bias is always D, though. I don't know.
Yeah, you know what they're looking for. But centers. And who gets paid the most? Centers.
Centers. Who gets paid most on July 1st, though?
John Tavares, who's a center.
Defenseman.
Yeah.
Always like this year.
You know who's going to get, and he had a big game the other night. You know who's going to get paid this year? Riley Nash.
Hmm.
Okay. And how many centers are available this year? There's Tavares. There's Stasny. There's Tyler Bozak. There's someone I'm missing who's around their level. And there's Riley Nash. You know, Riley Nash is a good player who's come a long way and probably wasn't as known because he played in Carolina. But this year in Boston, he has a great year. He has 12 points in 12 games when Bergeron gets hurt, and then he misses a game in the playoffs and he plays really well. He's a center. He's going to get paid.
Mm-hmm. One more, quickly. I know we're kind of pooched on time, Tim. We apologize. We'll do extra Ask 31s next week. Yeah. How about that? We'll make this up to you.
Yeah.
I want to conclude on the Norris. Doughty, Subban, Hedman. Zero problem with any of them.
Yeah.
Outstanding. I'll ask the same question that I asked about the Selke. My answer is Seth Jones. Who's yours? Who's the guy knocking on that door to get in that conversation?
Well, I'll tell you who was in the top five of my ballot. Okay. And I won't put them in where I had them. I mean, I had the three finalists. They were on my ballot. They were in the top three positions. And then the other two guys on my ballot were Roman Josi and Seth Jones. And Nashville guys are really tough for me because they're all great. Like, to me, Ekholm is unbelievable. But the reason I went with Subban over Josi is because he had even strength points up the wazoo. He led all the even strength points.
Yep.
And actually, it's been interesting. If you look at the regular season, Subban had the tougher setups. And in the playoffs, Josi does, to the point where we've seen so far in the Colorado series. So that makes it more difficult. But that's why I went with Subban over Josi.
Because you know, he starts in his own zone more than Josi does.
And he led the all D and even strength points in the league this year. I mean, that's something. But he got the tougher starts. The guy who I think gets totally shafted, and again, I kind of shafted him because I left him off my ballot. He was number six.
Mark Giordano?
No. Mark Edward Vlasic.
100%.
Mark Edward Vlasic gets more shafted for awards than I think any other player in the league.
Because nothing that he does is spectacular, and he's overshadowed by Brent Burns.
Absolutely. Like, I wanted to vote for him the Lady Bing this year. He took
a defenseman? Oh, my goodness. Brian Campbell, Red Kelly?
You know, he took... You know how many penalties he took this year?
Vlasic?
Yeah.
I don't know.
He took five. Two for puck over the glass, and three misconducts.
Nice. He had misconduct. 34 that
minutes,
boy, kid.
34 minutes in penalties. Yeah. Four for over the glass.
Okay, so he's still not Ryan O'Reilly, though. But still, your point's well
made. Yeah, but like I wanted to put him number one on my ballot. I think more defensemen should be in the Bing conversation. And Nick Kiprios is like, I was telling you, he says, you can't put a guy who had three misconducts in for the Lady Bing. And I'm like, yeah, you're right.
He got to you. Kipper got to you. Kipper logic. On that, we'll wrap it up. Thanks so much for the downloads. Thanks so much for your ears this week. We'll probably do a longer podcast, at least more Ask 31s next week. I know we kind of pooched you a little bit this week, but some scheduling challenges kind of buttressed everything, but that's cool. I'll make up for it next week. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to Jack Edwards for stopping by from Nesson. He was a lot of fun to talk to. Hope you enjoyed the interview. Thanks to Emil Delich. And thanks to our good friends at GMC for making all of this possible and creating a nice little cradle for us to sleep in. Thank you, fine automobile manufacturer. Thanks, Elliot. We'll talk to you next week. I'm a vessel.